welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Friday, January 17th, 2025. The head of South Sudan's Echo TV talks to us about conditions in Juba after the protests.
The reason why we felt in particular we had to speak out today is because of these reports of an imminent battle for Khartoum. We are worried about the kinds of violations that we may see as the parties to the conflict battle for control at all costs.
That's a UN commission official talking about the situation in Khartoum, and an analyst looks at why the Biden administration's decided to sanction the head of the Sudanese army now.
You have to question why they would sanction these two individuals now. Why are they doing things at the end of this administration that don't get us any closer to peace?
These stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk warns that the conflict in Sudan is taking a more dangerous turn for civilians amid reports of an imminent battle for control of the capital, Khartoum. He says there is evidence of war crimes being committed by both parties to the conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Türk says the situation for civilians in Sudan is increasingly desperate as the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces battle for control at all costs. He says the war that has been raging for nearly 2 years has taken a more dangerous turn as evidence emerges of war crimes and other atrocities. In the last week alone, his spokesperson, Ravina Shamdasani, says the UN Human Rights Office documented at least 21 deaths and two attacks in Al Jazeera state. She adds the actual number of direct attacks on civilians and of those who have been killed is probably much higher.
The reason why we felt in particular we had to speak out today is because of these reports of an imminent battle for Khartoum. We are worried about the kinds of violations that we may see as the parties to the conflict battle for control at all costs for Khartoum. And we are worried that this is taking us further away from peace and further into a horrific situation for civilians.
Shamdasani says her office has received three videos that document scenes of violence, including killings, showing people being dehumanized and denigrated. She says the victims were subjected to violence, summary executions in what were hailed by perpetrators as a cleansing operation. She adds the videos reportedly were filmed in Wad Madani with men in SAF uniforms visibly present.
Serious concerns also persist for civilians in North Darfur, where ethnically motivated attacks by RSF and its allied Arab militias against African ethnic groups, particularly the Zagawa and the Fur, continue to exact a horrific toll.
Shamdasani says the High Commissioner is calling on all states to abide by a UN arms embargo and refrain from providing the warring parties with lethal weapons. The United States declared sanctions on Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan Thursday, a week after the U.S. slapped sanctions on RSF Commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglo. Shamdasani says her office generally opposes broad sectoral sanctions as they can harm the civilian population. However, she notes targeted sanctions can be effective in exerting pressure on specific individuals and organizations responsible for the conflict. Sudan's army-aligned foreign ministry rejected the U.S. sanctions, calling them immoral. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As you just heard, the U.S. has sanctioned Sudanese army leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan after doing the same earlier with the head of the RSF. I asked Cameron Hudson, senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, for his thoughts on the Biden administration policy towards Sudan.
Well, I think that the reason for the sanction is because to the extent that the Biden administration has a policy in Sudan, it is to treat the two warring sides as equally culpable, equally responsible, and equally illegitimate. And so you saw in the Hemeti sanction that the administration went to some lengths to say that this sanction against the RSF leader does not mean that we support the RSF. or rather, it doesn't mean we support the SAF because we've sanctioned the RSF leader. And similarly, in the sanction announcement yesterday, they go to great lengths to say, we believe that neither side is legitimate. We believe that neither side has the legitimacy to govern a future peaceful Sudan. The rub there, though, is that these sanctions coming in the last days of the administration do nothing to get us any closer to a future peace in Sudan. And so you have to question why they would sanction these two individuals now. Why are they doing things at the end of this administration that don't get us any closer to peace? And so the only explanation that I could come up with is that these are purely punitive measures, and it is a reflection of a Biden administration that has been, I think, very moralistic, you know, declarative on the crimes that have been committed in this war, but not terribly practical in terms of using these various tools to advance a peace agenda or to advance an agenda that opens humanitarian access. You know, if we're going to make an assessment of the Biden administration policy towards Sudan, it's been high on morality and low on practicality.
All the while, the suffering continues for the Sudanese citizens that are still there, even though tens of thousands have been killed in this fighting. Some will say that really our hands are tied. If you talk about outside countries in the West, what can we do? Because you get accused of meddling, you get accused of all kinds of things if you send in troops in this civil war as it is. So what can the U.S. and other governments do besides trying to exert more pressure on the two warring parties for opening up humanitarian access? What can they do to try to quicken the end of this war?
Well, I think that, you know, we're about to see the Trump administration come in, and I would hope and argue that a different approach is needed, that, you know, simply lecturing on human rights abuses and sort of defending civilians, as much as that might be a kind of, you know, feel-good set of policies, it actually doesn't serve the Sudanese people who we claim to be defending, because, again, we're no closer to ending the war.
That was Cameron Hudson, senior fellow at the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with me earlier today. Patrick Goyette, the CEO of Juba Echo TV and editor-in-chief of the station, is here in Washington to attend the inaugural of President-elect Donald Trump on Monday. And I had a chance to sit down and speak with him in our studios just before the show. Thanks for being here, Patrick.
You are welcome. Thank you so much also for inviting me.
I'd like to begin by asking you about the situation in South Sudan right now. People continue to suffer with the deteriorating economy and civil workers not being paid on time. Can you fill us in just a little bit on how things are right now at home, back at home in Juba?
Yeah, things are not good. For example, today all shops are closed, by the way. This is as a result of fighting that took place in Sudan, and there have been a report that South Sudanese were killed. And as such, there were protests yesterday in Juba, and some shops belonging to Sudanese were vandalized. So today, all shops in Juba, first of all, are closed. And the government has just declared a curfew that from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., people should not move. But that's just one part. The other issue is, of course, the economy is not doing well. The oil production had shut down for a year. And, you know, South Sudan's economy depends largely on oil. Actually, oil money funds about 90% of the budget of South Sudan. So as such, civil servants have not been paid for a year now.
A year. I mean, that's crazy. How do they survive?
Well, many of the civil servants have to, you know, do some private work. For example, you go and work half day, and then you have to go and ride motorcycle taxi to generate some little money.
Or all because the government is not paying
because
them for
the
their
is
work
not paying.
That they are doing every day.
Exactly, exactly. So you have to do something to at least get some money, or, you know, you have to maybe make what we call chapati. Chapati is a kind of bread made of wheat flour, and you sell so that you get something small to keep the family.
I can't even imagine. So you mentioned about the curfew. Juba and several other towns are under this curfew after the riots broke out, I believe over this alleged massacre that involved the South Sudanese civilians in Sudan's Wad Madani. What do you know about that?
Well, the president has just released a statement, which I have seen. President Salva Kiir has called for calm and has said that he has instructed the Minister of Foreign Affairs to talk to the Sudanese ambassador in South Sudan to ensure that there is investigation into what happened in Wad Madani so that a proper report is given. But of course, today there has been really tension. I have called home. They told me all shops are closed. They had to go to a factory to look for water for drinking because nobody is working. So the situation remains tense.
I can imagine. And so finally, just give me the idea or the sentiments you're feeling right now about the upcoming inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, and you're here for that.
I am very, very excited because, you know, in South Sudan, we've never had elections since we got independence. As a journalist, I've never covered. And to be here to really witness how democracy works and to see how power is, you know, transferred from one president to another president-elect is amazing. And I believe this is giving me experience to prepare for our elections, which is scheduled for 2026. It was supposed to happen last year, but it has been postponed for several reasons. So, yes, we are waiting for that, and I hope this covering this inauguration is going to give me a bit of an idea of how to cover ours when the time comes.
That's Patrick Oyet, CEO of Juba Echo TV and editor-in-chief, speaking with me in our studios earlier today. We'll have more on that South Sudan protest and the curfew later in the show. On VOA Straight Talk Africa this week, host Peter Clottey focused on the Sudan war between the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF. His guests included Danica Damplo, policy manager at the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and Jean-Baptiste Gallopin, researcher at the Crisis, Conflict, and Arms Division of Human Rights Watch. Here's an excerpt of the show.
I'm joined by Danica Damplo, policy manager at the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington, D.C. From Kitchener, Canada, I'm joined by Brian Adeba, senior policy advisor at the Centre for Sudan and South Sudan. And from Paris, we are joined by Jean-Baptiste Gallopin, a senior researcher for Crisis, Conflict and Arms of Human Rights Watch. All right, so let me come to you, Danica, first. The U.S. has designated Sudan genocide. What does this mean, and how do you see this playing on the ground?
Thank you so much again for having me on this panel. To begin with, I think we should recognize that this determination is also a recognition of a failure by the international community to prevent the genocide that we're seeing in Darfur. As Nicole Wittersheim of Human Rights Watch mentioned, this is the second time in a few decades that this determination has been made. In terms of, we also should recognize that this determination is being made as mass atrocities are ongoing. So in terms of events on the ground, we continue to see genocidal violence in Darfur, as well as the risk of mass atrocities and ongoing mass atrocities throughout Sudan.
Jean-Baptiste, let me come to you. Recently, you were in Sudan. You visited a few places as part of your research. What is the latest development on the ground? What did you witness while you were there?
Thank you for having me. Since the conflict started, we've been doing a lot of work documenting abuses by the warring parties, working with a number of methods, both remotely but also in refugee camps in Chad and South Sudan, as well as most recently within Sudan, where we managed to travel to South Kordofan, part of the countries that has witnessed RSF attacks against communities who were mainly from the Nuba ethnic group. And, you know, what we found there was widespread attacks against the populations, including killings, destruction of homes, systematic looting and burning of homes, and also rape and sexual violence, including a case my colleague documented. This woman who was detained alongside 49 other women on an RSF base and gang raped every day by RSF fighters. Now, these abuses are really emblematic of the atrocities that we're continuing to see in Sudan and really mirror what we found in other places, including West Darfur, where, you know, we found that the RSF had carried out ethnic cleansing and against the Masalit population of the capital city of El Geneina, and that these crimes amounted to crimes against humanity and widespread war crimes. So we're very, very alarmed by the continued atrocities that are being carried out in Sudan. Just this past few days, we've seen horrific images coming out of Al Jazeera state, where communities had been occupied by the RSF and were already bearing the brunt of atrocities. And now we're seeing atrocities being carried out by forces loyal to the Sudanese military after they reconquered areas of around Wad Madani.
That's my colleague Peter Clotty speaking about Sudan with his guests on Straight Talk Africa. The Israeli Security Cabinet has approved a Gaza ceasefire deal today, but the full government still has yet to vote on it, which could happen by tomorrow. Edmund Gharib, Lebanese-American scholar at the Washington Institute for Peace and Development and a former scholar at American University, in part two of our conversation, answers my question about what happens next.
Who will control Gaza once these Israeli troops, you know, do finally leave?
That's really, this is a very, very good question. As you said, this is a big question because there had been, first of all, there was an offer suggestion that maybe Hamas would agree to establish a group from Gaza who would cooperate with the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, and that sort there would be a return of the Palestinian Authority to Gaza, to rule the, and run Gaza. However, there have been reports that Netanyahu didn't want the also the Palestinian Authority to return, which is...
Well, isn't it also true that besides Netanyahu not wanting the Palestinian Authority to come back, isn't it true that a lot of, you know, Palestinians don't really want the Palestinian Authority? There was a lot of talk about it being corrupt and... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just don't know that they want it either. So is that something that is going to be a problem, you know, down the road?
Absolutely. I think that's a very important factor, too. That's because a lot of Palestinians, as you pointed out, have viewed the Palestinian Authority in Gaza as not, first of all, not reflecting their interests, that there have been also many of its the officials have been corrupt. And it had been or incompetent. And so there are a lot of questions about that. And there is also, there's been talk apparently as well during these negotiations that there might be a role for some of the Arab countries, such as those who were involved in the debates, to probably send some troops as well as the international community here. The UN might have a role to play. There's been talk about that. But it is still apparently quite vague. I think this is, they have left this, they wanted to reach at least the first phase of the negotiations and while continuing to negotiate about the end. And I think the day after is part of this this very, very sensitive and important negotiation that's going to be, because this will be very, very important as to whether this agreement would hold or not.
That's Edmund Gharib, Lebanese-American scholar at the Washington Institute for Peace and Development, speaking with me earlier. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, Sudan's top diplomat is summoned in Juba.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today...
What skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands, that is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay at work.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. South Sudan's government is demanding a response from the Khartoum government after reports that Sudan's armed forces killed South Sudanese civilians in the town of Wad Madani. Sheila Pony reports for VOA from Juba.
Unverified videos have surfaced online of civilians killed by people in Sudanese military uniforms in the town of Wad Madani. The Sudan Armed Forces recently recaptured the town from the paramilitary rapid support forces. In response to the videos, protests arose across the South Sudan capital Thursday night, with some protesters attacking Sudanese nationals in revenge. South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs Undersecretary John Samuel Bwaga says his government summoned Sudan's envoy, Muhammad Hassan Kara, to meet with government officials.
We invited him, we summoned him this evening to our ministry here to register our concern with regard to what is taking place in Jazeera with Madani after it has been liberated by the Sudanese armed forces from the Rapid Support Force.
South Sudan's first deputy speaker, Oyet Nathalie, says Sudan should be held accountable for failing to protect civilians.
Unfortunately, we have been following with a lot of disappointment that South Sudanese who are in the Sudan are being targeted. They are being targeted on the streets. They are being targeted in their houses. They are being targeted wherever they are.
The South Sudan government has yet to identify the exact number of casualties or reach out to the victims' families. Sudan's ambassador Hassan says his government is investigating the incident.
A committee has been established to investigate these crimes and to apprehend those responsible for them, whether against our South Sudanese brothers or Sudanese citizens in general.
Bol Joseph Agau is a member of South Sudan's parliament and a representative of the National Democratic Movement Party under the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. He urges restraint and compassion as South Sudan mourns its slain citizens.
Some people were slaughtered like animals, their eyes gouged out. This barbaric act must be condemned by the international community. I urge the civilized world to declare Sudan Armed Forces a terrorist entity. This is not just a South Sudanese issue. It is a global call for accountability.
Sudan's armed forces, led by General Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, have been fighting the paramilitary rapid support forces for nearly 2 years. The conflict has caused tens of thousands of civilians' death, created the world's largest displacement crisis with nearly 12 million people forced from their homes, and brought many communities to the brink of famine. For VOA News, I am Sheila Pony, Juba.
With me here in the studio now is a young South Sudanese activist named Neil Deng, who is an award-winning youth advocate, storyteller, and community activist with experience in policy advocacy and international development. Neil, thanks for joining us. You grew up in a Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. That's a huge camp, isn't it?
Yeah, Kakuma is a big refugee camp with about 280,000 refugees.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about that experience and then how you evolved into what you are now doing today.
Thank you so much for having me. Kakuma refugee camp, as I mentioned, of course, is a big refugee camp with about 280,000 refugees from all across East Africa. Majority, of course, come from South Sudan, Somalia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Like many South Sudanese family, my family has been affected by the conflict back home. My father first fled the Sudanese civil war, moved to Ethiopia where I was born, and then later we find ourselves in Kakuma refugee camp where I spent the most of my childhood. And growing up in the refugee camp, I was very passionate about leadership, about journalism. Storytelling was a big part of my childhood, my father upbringing. He would tell me about his stories about South Sudan, and I'd go to school and just talk to other kids, hear about their stories, how they got to the refugee camp. And I feel like we need a space where young people can come together to talk about their stories, to talk about hope, to play together, to be happy. And that is how my community leadership work started. When I was in high school, I created a youth group that used to bring young people together. We used to run mentorship program, leadership workshop. We used to have game and sport activities. And then
if I may interrupt a little, it sounds like you
had a good education. Was that in the camp?
Yeah. All my education was in the camp. I did my elementary school in the camp. I did my high school in the camp. And I started my leadership work when I was in high school in the camp. It wasn't the best education. The school, I remember, were crowded. We did not have enough resources. We did not have qualified teachers. But I remember education was more than just learning for us. It was a space where you can go and think about a glowing future. It was a space where you can heal from your trauma. It was a space where you can think about hope again. So it was one that space where many kids in the refugee camp would go, and through education they see a brighter future, they see a hope for them in the future, they feel like they could go back home to their home country and help rebuild it, they feel like they could, you know, achieve their dreams.
Give them a sense of hope.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were there for how many years?
I was there for 11 years.
Wow. In a refugee camp for 11 years. Is that normal?
Yes. There are people who have stayed there for about, you know, two decades. Kakuma Refugee Camp was set up first in 1991, and there are families that I've met in the camp who are still living there today. My family actually still live in the camp, so I go back to the camp quite frequently. I still run a lot of leadership and mentorship program for young people in the camp, so I go there about 3 to 4 times a year, and there are many families that have lived there for about two decades.
So just briefly, how did you get from there to here, what you're doing now?
Yes, so when I finished high school, I continued doing my leadership work, and then, you know, many international organizations came to learn about my work and my story, and I started receiving invitations to speak at different conferences about young people and displacement and, you know, peace and conflict. And then in 2021, I won a full scholarship to move to Canada. So I'm now in Canada finishing my undergraduate degree in international development and communications, and then I'm currently based in New York doing an internship at the United Nations.
Well, that is one terrific story, and we're so glad that you were able to join us today, and I'm really happy about your future. I think that you've got a bright future.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That is Niall Deng. He, as you just heard, he's an award-winning youth advocate, storyteller, and community activist, and he was here with us in the studio. And finally, we have our weekly listener comments for you with VOA's Jackson Mvunganje.
From Shirikat Juba, Giet Gabriel Atem wrote, families are struggling with hyperinflation, a steep drop in the value of their currency, and food prices. He attributes this to the political situation. Both Gwapol Niall is requesting your help to search for my brother's family in Eastern Nile province, Jerep, near Bridge. Her name is Nyachokwich Dia Ruak with her children. And finally, James Luay Majok from Unity State Bentui Town wrote, hi, VOA South Sudan in Focus team at the Voice of America. I'm really excited about resumption of Tumaini peace talks that will resume very soon in Nairobi, Kenya, between holdout groups and South Sudan government delegations. As citizens of the country, South Sudan, we need peace rather than returning back to war that devastated our country.
Hello, South Sudan in Focus. This is Kinamboli Christopher from Juba, capital city of South Sudan. I'm just trying to urge the government to look into the insecurity which started yesterday around Juba city. And really, we, the citizen, at first, we don't know what was happening. Just the sound of gun started rapping everywhere. People are suffering from hunger, and the things are expensive. Those are the things really our government need to look at it. Passing my regards to my family members and all the listeners of South Sudan in Focus, and I appreciate all the team for the hard work they are doing there.
And that wraps it up for us this Friday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed the beginning of this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Unavailable by Davido. We've been listening to Jamoko, or no, it's not Jamoko. Today we have Unavailable, that's right, by Davido. I just didn't finish wrapping that up.
And I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Justin Thwaites, and producer, Mukbil Yabro, and our special guest, Neil Deng, we thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk with you on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Listen in on South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Changing my life, oh, how my mama proud of me. She got me going.